Hello and welcome to Ed Talks, the podcast from King Edward School Birmingham and King Edward's High School for Girls, where I talk to old Eds who've gone off to pursue careers in all sorts of different fields across the world. My name is Ben Anderson. I left school and went to Warwick University and went into the radio industry, producing breakfast shows for Capital FM and then running three stations for Capital FM in the north. I now run a podcast production company, Sound Rebel, and this is one of my absolute favourite podcasts to do because it's so great to connect with old Edwardians and people connected with the school, because this is the first time we've got an old Ed featuring on the podcast and also a King Edward's parents. I'd like to introduce Dr. Chris Duncan and Dr. Saab Clare. Thank you both ever so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much for inviting us.
So, Chris, you are the old Edwardian. You left school in 2009.
I am indeed, and yes, I did.
And Saab, you are our parent. Have you got children currently at the school?
Yes, just the one boy. He's 14, so he's in year 10.
Difficult time.
I think he's a bit chilled, but yeah.
A bit too chilled.
Yeah.
We're talking to you together today because you have written a medical textbook together, which has been published by Cambridge University Press about point of care ultrasound, which is revolutionising patient care. And I can't wait to talk to you about that. But you didn't know about the King Edward's connection between you until you started working together. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. My boy wanted to, desperate to go to Cares. And when I was working with Chris, he told me he went to Cares. And really, you know, Chris is so talented. He's so driven. It just made me put more pressure on my boy to get to Cares. He's got, he's really sporty and got great opportunities and networking and so forth. So, yeah, he's been there and he's loving it. It's fantastic.
Chris, tell us about your career then. I mean, you both got many strings to your bow. We're going to be talking about the textbook a lot today. But so you left Cares in 2009. What did you do next?
Yeah, so I left in 2009. I went to Nottingham University, did medicine there. And then after my 5 years in Nottingham, I stayed there for another 2 years and did my first couple of years of medical training there. And then after 7 years in one place, I'd gone a little bit stir crazy. So I moved back to Birmingham, where quite a lot of my old school friends, I still had a reasonable group of school friends, were still there or had dispersed and then come back. And then I went into anesthesia training in the West Mids. I stayed there for 4 years, which is the time that I worked with Saab in her brilliant acute med department. And then after 4 years working in Birmingham again, I have now moved down to London and I've gone into specialist training in intensive care. And I've been here now for about a year and a half now. And that's where we are. And I should have another couple of years of training here and then I'm done. So then I'll be fully trained as a consultant, although I'm toying with the idea of moving abroad for a bit and doing some training elsewhere. But we'll see about that.
Very nice. Why not? Somewhere sunny?
Probably.
If you can, why not?
Absolutely.
Chris, you're late 20s, early 30s, just doing the quick maths.
30s, yeah.
When you left school. Mm. You've obviously been working on the front line of the pandemic as well. I mean, how has that been in terms of kind of, you know, medical school wasn't really that long ago in the kind of grand scheme of life. And then you come out and you're now thrown into the start of your career, a pandemic the likes which you haven't seen in the UK, at least since, 100 years ago. How's it been diving into that?
Well, I think, look, it's been difficult for everyone for many different reasons. My specialty is intensive care and we were really, really blessed to have so many people who came and volunteered their time out of their comfort zones to help us out, because we suddenly were exposed to huge volumes of patients with having to still do the same amount of interventions that we're used to doing, but under much more difficult circumstances. And you know, in the first wave, it was obviously quite challenging because we didn't really know anything about this. We didn't know whether we were in harm's way. We didn't know whether our friends and family were going to be in harm's way. We didn't know whether we were susceptible to it. So it was obviously very challenging. It made us learn very quickly what we should and shouldn't do, I think it probably made some of us better at our job. It was challenging from a emotional perspective, from a physical perspective. We all worked very long hours, and it was difficult not seeing our family. I mean, of course, it wasn't all bad. There were lots of people who lost their jobs. We had suddenly the most secure job in the world, working in a hospital, and we actually did get to interact with people. So we can't underestimate the benefit of being able to have that human interaction during a very difficult time where lots of other people were really struggling. So it was obviously challenging. It was difficult. It was something that we'll all look back on with mixed feelings, but we've got to acknowledge that there were positives to actually continue to work in that environment as well.
As a young man in this environment, you've trained and you're very highly trained. You talk about emotions coming into it. Is it easy to separate the kind of what you're doing on a day-to-day basis and the tasks that you've got ahead of you to make sure that you're giving the best care possible to the people under your care? Do you take it home? Are you good at kind of closing the door and saying, right, I'm at home now and I'm back to work tomorrow? Is that just not possible in a situation like this?
I think what was really interesting about the pandemic was that suddenly all of the balance that you are very careful to have in your life was removed quite rapidly. It suddenly wasn't something that you did to enable yourself to have a life. It was something that was your entire life. There was nothing else happening. I was living on my own in Birmingham as well, so I didn't necessarily have people to go back home to and talk about it. I'm generally very good at compartmentalizing. It sounds quite cold, but you actually do learn to compartmentalize quite well, because what unfortunately is often the worst day of someone's life does very much become routine for you, and you've got to maintain that empathy and that sympathy and that human contact. But we are seeing things quite routinely, and we are seeing bad things quite routinely. So I've learned to compartmentalize well. Not everyone does, and that is difficult, but it's something that I've worked on. I always make sure I have balance in my life. I always make sure that that isn't everything that I'm doing, because otherwise it does become too much. But that was probably one of the harder elements of COVID, the fact that we were spending our entire time working in a more concerning environment for many of us, seeing a lot of bad things. And also, actually, a lot of the humanity was taken out of the work we were doing because the patient volume was so high. We didn't have families in the hospital. We didn't see that connection with their lives. We just saw a sick person that we had to try and get through.
Saab, you were also working on the front lines. But before we talk about COVID, can you tell us about some of your other roles? Because you've got so much going on.
Yeah, I do quite a bit. So I've been a doctor for quite some time, nearly 23 years. And I've done a lot generally, but more so going into management leadership. I've done a lot of teaching and education. Currently, I'm the deputy medical director at my trust. And also I'm clinically leading our trust to move into our new hospital, which is called the Midland Metropolitan University Hospital, which is based in Smethwick, one of the most deprived areas in the country. So it's really exciting that we're getting a new hospital and we can provide the best high quality care that our people deserve. So an exciting time. And as you can imagine, leading teams, consultants, nursing and everyone else is challenging. But, and I think, you know, when people apply into medicine, they don't see all the other things that you can do, from quality improvement, big projects, just leadership, delivering high quality care on big numbers, not just the one-to-one patient, but you're talking about your thousands, your hundreds of thousands of patients. So I've climbed the ladder quite quickly. I really enjoy the whole aspect of leadership and bringing on change and the influence you can have as a senior leader.
So taking you back to March 2020 then, you're clinical lead for the new hospital. You're a podcaster as well. Need to throw that one in there. You've got all these different things going on. Did that all stop for you then when the pandemic hit?
Yes. So everything stopped, and it was just, I threw myself onto the floor leading. A lot of our colleagues became sick, but it was not just that. It was the other bits that you had to do. So whilst you're seeing patients in the evenings, I was, if I had the evenings, I was rewriting rotas. I was creating educational packages for non-medical staff to be educated and move onto the sort of front line, dealing with sort of, you know, colleagues who were really struggling. And as leaders, people come to you to solve their problems. So you're trying to do everything. I mean, for me, it was just making sure my team were safe and making sure that we were delivering the best care possible. But one of the things I said at the beginning to my team is that we need to try and save as many people as possible and do what we can. And that really brought the team together.
And just listening to Chris describe his experience, does having nearly 23 years of experience doing this every day, does it equip you more for something like this or not? Is this something that's so unusual that it doesn't matter how much experience you've had, it affects you in similar ways?
Yeah, I really think it depends on your personality and your experience, definitely. I think it's your makeup of who you are, because I'm an acute physician, so I deal with the sickest patients as Chris deals with really sick patients in intensive care. But what we do is we are dealing with sick patients every single day, but it was just the volume. So, you know, we wouldn't see that many people dying every day, and that was quite sort of breathtaking. But like Chris, I tend to sort of get on with it. And because I also knew I had a team under me that I had to look after. So as a leader, I had to be leading the way, and he was leading by example as well. But yes, there's no doubt it was tough. And like Chris, I was incredibly thankful and grateful and really showing gratitude. Oh my God, I've got a job. I can go and see people. I can leave the house. And more importantly, I have got the skills to be able to save people's lives. So for me, that was the core value for me.
Where are we now? We're recording this in January. In fact, we're recording this episode will be out on Monday. So, you know, very close to the time that we're recording, people will be listening to this. Birmingham, Saab is where you're based in Edgbaston. You're in London, Chris. What's the picture looking like now? It feels like the news agenda has slightly shifted recently towards parties and licence fees. But from your perspective, being there on the ground, where are we now? Are you feeling positive about the place that, well, not just the country, but the NHS in particular is in? Are we still seeing shortages of staff? Like, what's happening on the ground now?
I mean, I work in City Hospital, which serves, as I said, Smethwick, Handsworth, Lascelles, one of the most deprived areas in the country. A lot of our patients are not vaccinated. A lot of our patients still do not believe in COVID. And we are still seeing large volumes of patients coming in with other things, but they are also COVID as well. And on top of that, we've got a huge amount of staff sickness, but also because their families have got COVID, so they have to isolate. And on top of that, it's still winter. So we're feeling huge amount of pressures. I mean, for instance, today I'm getting texted and saying, well, there's 18 patients bedded in the emergency department, ambulatory care is bedded, and the patients are really, really sick with a combination of winter. Patients have not been able to access community support and general practitioners. So unfortunately, the media is not demonstrating the reality of what is going on. On addition to that, you have got the accumulation of our workforce who is extremely tired, extremely exhausted. They've not been able to take their leave. I mean, over Christmas, I was meant to be on leave, but I was being called because lots of people were sick. So incredibly challenging. There's no doubt about it. The patients are not as sick as they have been in the previous two surges, but it's here and it's not going away.
And is that similar for you down in, what was once at one point called the COVID capital, Chris?
Is it still not? I mean, I think we've still got more cases than most places, haven't we? Yeah, I completely agree. We've got multiple issues, the foremost of which is staff fatigue and staff absence. This is something that has multiple reasons. COVID affects NHS staff as much as it affects everyone else. Quarantine rules, isolation rules, but also people have just had enough. There's only so long that people can work this hard for, and unfortunately, the media loses interest in one thing after a while, and no one wants to hear about COVID anymore. The reality is it still is around. We are still getting lots and lots and lots of admissions, particularly over the Christmas and New Year period. We were very, very busy. Vaccination has worked. We definitely have had significantly fewer patients admitted to intensive care compared to this time last year. I acutely remember when I was working overnight last Christmas, and it was slightly wild, very, very busy. We were over capacity by about 100% on intensive care. And this year, we didn't actually get that many on ITU. So it was more a case of the wards needing help with sick enough to be admitted, but not sick enough to come to ITU. So we've still got issues. And the major thing is just absences and fatigue.
I want to move on from COVID because we've got lots of other things to talk about. But I think kind of on a personal note from me, my nan was in hospital, not with COVID, over Christmas. The level of care she received over the Christmas period was incredible. And I know that so much time, energy, and so many resources are going towards battling the pandemic. But I think it's one of the most wonderful things about the NHS is that that level of care for everything else that still happens. She received an incredible level of care in Good Hope Hospital in Sutton Coldfield. The media aren't talking about it, yes, as much with parties and all sorts of other stuff that's making the headlines. But yes, very much kind of in the public consciousness. I do believe it's still, you know, a huge level of respect and admiration for the NHS. So medicine isn't just about treating people who aren't very well, is it? Let's talk about the textbook. And before we get into kind of the writing process, I know that things were delayed because of COVID and you've added a chapter in regards to COVID. The textbook is about point of care ultrasound. Would you mind explaining in kind of layman's terms what that means?
So ultrasound, people most commonly associate with going to get a scan when you're pregnant, a dating scan, confirming pregnancy, etc. The same technique can be used for investigating all sorts of organ systems, be it your heart, be it your lungs, be it your abdomen, be it your veins, your arteries, anything. Anything can really be assessed using ultrasounds. Historically, that's been the domain of radiologists or sonographers in their outpatient setting, in their own department, with big, fancy, expensive machines. With the development of newer, cheaper, smaller technology, we're seeing that these ultrasound machines can be far more portable, cheaper, more accessible. And nowadays, there's even machines that can plug into your phone or a tablet. So that fact has suddenly made it accessible for people like us who are in the front line, seeing patients at the bedside. And the true value for ultrasound is in that environment. We can get immediate answers. We can listen to a patient's chest, take a history, and then straight away we can confirm or refute the things that we think are going on. So it enables us to get one step further ahead for that patient to identify and to guide us for conventional examination and history taking and CT scanning and ultrasounds in departments and things like this. So it guides the investigations we need. It improves the patient's journey through the hospital because it means they don't sit on the ward for 3 days trying to get an ultrasound scan. And it strengthens the care that we can provide to people and get us back on track when we're going wrong. So really, it's transformed the way that we practice medicine. Obviously, I'm much younger, but it's something that I've been exposed to early in my career, and I couldn't imagine practicing now without it. And it allows us to get the diagnosis right.
So that's what we mean by point of care ultrasound then, is the portability. You're taking this to them.
So absolutely.
It makes the patient experience better. It gives you more information. What else do you cover in the textbook that you've released through?
I think that word portability is absolutely key because we've got a brilliant chapter on there about austere medicine and humanitarian work, because this diagnostic can be taken out to those communities who can't access healthcare. and we describe some work I've done in Cape Town, where we go to the townships and we're looking for heart problems in young kids. But normally these kids would never go into the hospitals because they can't get there. And you can save their lives. You can actually change their, you know, life journey by picking up these conditions. So the portability, absolutely. And that goes back to really COVID, really, where, you know, these patients were really sick, so they couldn't get to the CT scanners, but also there was too many patients that were needed the CT scan. But also we couldn't, you know, take these patients to the CT scanners because it would spread COVID across the hospital. So we were actually diagnosing COVID using our portable ultrasounds at the patient's bedside. And the patient themselves can see, oh my gosh, that I can see what's going on inside my body. And that was really great because they didn't have any families there. They didn't have anyone there. And it was just us and them. And it was great for them to see that they were getting better and so forth. So portability is absolutely the key.
And patients love it as well. Patients genuinely like it. You know, having used it a lot in the emergency department and in acute medicine, you know, you spend more time at their bedside rather than sitting on a computer requesting investigations or looking at x-rays. You can also show them the pictures. You can say, this is your heart. This is what I'm looking at. This is why I'm looking at it. And this is why we think you need to come into hospital. And this is what we need to do next. So people like that visual cue. They like the reassurance that you're doing that one extra thing for them. And they, you know, they get to spend a bit more time with the doctor, which often is time that's quite limited.
So this is your book is currently available in the UK, but soon to be internationally. Is that right?
It's available in Europe and I think in Australia, New Zealand, etc. But I think it's being released in other places at the end of this month.
Where does a project like this start? Like, how did you, first of all, how did you come together? How did you decide that this was the project that you wanted to work on?
Yeah, so Chris was my junior a few years ago. I can't remember what year, but I've been doing point-of-care ultrasound it's about 17 years now. And when I started it, everyone was looking at me thinking, what are you doing? You shouldn't be doing this. And I've been running courses and really using this technology to help me be a better clinician. And Chris was rotating onto our unit and really just ran with it, you know, started using it, wanted to get accredited. But more importantly, he saw the worth and he was seeing the cases that were actually changing because of the use of the ultrasound. And it was, once you see it, you'll never go back. And that's where we got together. And I had been sort of toying with the idea of writing a book. But when I met with Chris, it was like, I've got to work with this guy and we can do this together. And it was really interesting because when, I don't think I've told Chris this, but I was really apprehensive about asking him because I thought he'd just say no, but he was like, yeah. And I was like, okay, brilliant. And from that, I mean, Chris has done some great work in the sense he's created the website, which is fantastic. And yeah, that's how the journey started. We got our book deal with Cambridge. It was a bit of a roller coaster ride, but we got there. And it was meant to be out December 2020, but delayed because of COVID. And I think, you know, it all happened for a reason because we got to really show the value of point of care ultrasound within COVID. And that's how it happened. But it was a real journey, a mammoth task, especially because we were really finishing the manuscript during the second surge. And that was really, really tough because it was winter. And we were doing long shifts. And I look back at those days and I think, oh my God, how did we do this? But an incredible journey. And I'm really proud of what we've achieved.
So it's available now. If someone listening would like to go and read it, how can they do that?
So we have some information on our website, generalistultrasound.com. And for the non-medics, you may have to sift through some medical things. I apologize, but there's information about the book there. It is available on all good bookstores and websites, including Amazon. So you can just Google Ultrasound for the Generalist on Amazon, and you can see it there. On the Cambridge University Press website, there is more information there, including some interviews with us and a few other people about the book. And yeah, I think that's about it.
Hi, I'm Sana.
And I'm Betty, and we've been fundraising in support of the Assisted Places Scheme across each school. What's that, you ask?
The Assisted Places Scheme aims to provide access to excellence for all. So if you want to make a change,
start small and support the campaign. Thank you.
Got a couple more things I'd like to ask you before we go, but whilst we're in plugging mode, Saab, let's talk about your podcast. So Women Empowering Women is the title of the podcast. Where did this come from? How long have you been doing it for? Tell me everything. I love podcasts.
Yeah, so it's a movement that started in 2019, and it really stemmed from lots of sort of female colleagues and juniors coming to me, you know, describing imposter syndrome or feeling that they couldn't achieve or they couldn't compete against, you know, their male colleagues. And I was like, what's wrong with you guys? You just got to go for it. So what I did is I set up a sort of, the first thing we did a national conference, which involved role modeling. So if you can see it, you can be it. So I was demonstrating, look at these women, they've done research, they've done teaching education, they've had families, but they've still had great careers within medicine. And that was really the key thing, role modeling. If you can see it, you can be it, creating a network. And then from that, done various other workshops. I mean, one of them is called Fearless, and it's talking about, you know, how to stand up to those who are, you know, physically and verbally abusing you, because it's unfortunately quite rife in the NHS. And we've done another workshop last year called Being an Ally. How do you, you know, what I found is that most women don't want to speak up, especially within the NHS, and medics in general do not speak up because they want to move up ahead the career ladder. But if you can't speak up, then you need to be an ally to speak up. And then from this, we've also created a website, womenempoweringwomen.org. And then we created a podcast. And the podcast was really about showcasing women who are relatable, who've had ups and downs, but sharing their journey, sharing their top tips, and saying to women out there, whatever you want, you can achieve it. Yes, you have to work hard. Yes, you may have to face up sexism, but it's about mindset, and it's a bit about changing the way you approach things and so forth. And from that was my TEDx talk with the school as well, which was, I think it was a year. Yeah, it was in 2020. I did the KES TEDx talk. And it was really about, you know, we as women need to help each other. Because what you find is a lot of women that go up the ladder, they tend to pull that ladder up rather than helping each other. And actually helping each other, you can gain a huge amount. So that project is really, again, it's grown legs. And we're now setting up a committee, and we've got another session coming up. And that's really going to be about the stuff around, like, Sarah Everard, about how do you essentially fight off a man, and giving the skills to women to be able to do that, because that's reality of life, with some people from the police force coming to speak to women to essentially reassure them that, you know, that they can speak up. So, yeah, a great project, but completely different. But all to do with medicine in a way, because medicine in a way has created a lot of these issues, inability to speak up, imposter syndrome, simple things like women get paid significantly less than their counterparts who are men.
So if you ever need any guests, we've had this conversation comes up so much on this podcast. I'm just thinking, in this series, we've had Meletti and Beth Heaven. Beth works for Disney. Mel is a Fulbright scholar over at Harvard, doing a master's in public health. They both talk about how the school kind of gave them the exactly what you've been talking about, that there's no boundaries for them. I love the line, if you can see it, you can be it. And it does feel like that is a kind of King Edwards thing. I'd love to, obviously, this is a podcast for King Edwards and King Edwards High School, so I'd love to bring it back to the schools now and talk to you, because another thing that keeps coming up is the idea that there's almost a belief system, a kind of value system. You're not just taught science and maths and English and whatever else at King Edwards. There is I'm not sure if you're seeing it with your son going through the school, but there's a kind of a way to be and a way to approach life that I think the school provides you with. Chris, would you agree with that? Do you think that King Edwards, it's not just about kind of, this is the job that you'd like to do, so this is the education we need to provide? Do you feel like it gave you more than that?
Completely, completely. I think the interesting thing about KES that I remember, I look back on my time there very fondly. I had an incredible time. I think The thing with Kes is that you get such a varied array of experience there. It's encouraged for you to do as much as possible. I mean, my time there, academics was secondary. I mean, academics has always got to be there for doing well in exams or getting to university if that's your chosen route, or to do the things you want to do. But it was never considered to be the main thing. In fact, actually, I remember very clearly being told that I wasn't going to get into medicine because of my aversion to doing homework. So I think the varied experiences and the exposure to all sorts of things just makes you such a better, well-rounded person. I mean, my involvement in sport gave me the skill to work in teams, the leadership role, the focus, the dedication to one thing, the discipline, all the music things I did reminded me that I had to be regularly practicing something, that nothing came with small amounts of effort, that the end result would always be through hard work. The education that we got there was obviously very good. It was obviously focused towards exams because that was a fundamental thing, but we learned how to learn. And I think all of those things really do give you conviction in your own abilities. It gives you a degree of confidence, but not overconfidence. Of course, there's always a degree of overconfidence from time to time. However, there are such intelligent people at that school in their own areas. There's always going to be a better musician. There's always going to be a better sportsman. There's always going to be someone who's incredible at maths. And that levels you to a degree. So I definitely think that the varied experience teaches you fundamental life skills that are sort of cloaked in a fun way that you don't realize you've got until you leave. And then those things have definitely really helped me. I mean, my work ethic definitely didn't really happen, shall we say, until probably my last year of medical school and then starting a new job. But it was still fundamental things that I had learned previously and that had been instilled within me.
So from the boy who struggled to get his homework into a man who's now written a book that is being read across the world.
Indeed.
Bonkers. You know what, Saab, I'd like to ask you this question. I always end with the same question in this podcast. You would have heard it. I know you've listened to a few episodes, Chris, because you were of the same kind of cohort as, is it Xander Weaver? You were
yes.
in the same year as at school.
I was in the same year as Xander. And the same house. And I was in the same house as Xander, Elliot, and Seb Heaven. So
yes, who's also been on the podcast.
Absolutely.
I was best man for a couple of months ago in
Canada.
Oh,
wow.
But usually I do ask you'll know this question, but I ask the people who's been. But I think it'd be really interesting from your perspective, Saab, in terms of what characteristic is the question? What characteristic do you think has served you best since leaving school? I suppose, what characteristic do you hope that your son, if you could pinpoint just one, what do you hope that he comes out of King Edward School with?
If it's one, it would be resilience. I mean, I'm already seeing from him, and he's changed, is real. He's gained that, he's gained that drive. He's gained that discipline. And I don't have to do anything, which is great. And I see that, in Chris, his work ethic, his drive, his passion, and that self-motivation, which is, no one needs to motivate, Chris, because he's got that drive already. So, and I'm seeing little snippets in my son already. I mean, for the past few years, you can see that he's getting disciplined. And if he wants to do well in his test, he's going to have to work at it. He wants to get into the polo team. Well, he's going to have to get more fit. So, and he loves the sports as well. And I really like the way Chris is just sort of, disguised as a cloak. Actually, it's a fun way, but you've got all those great opportunities, which is brilliant.
I think from my side, just for completion, I think resilience is obviously something that is essential in life for everything that you do. But it does kind of make, I know loads of people have said it, and I think it's true, but it does in a way make it sound like school's got to teach you how to deal with the bad stuff. And that's definitely, that of course is the case. And resilience is essential for making the most out of life experiences. But I definitely think that another thing, just to, as a principle, is just to be open-minded. I think Kez really, really instilled in me an open-mindedness because I had so many experiences. You know, I got to play whatever sport I wanted, even if they overlapped and I disappointed people from time to time. I got to do music, play random things, do the academic work when I had to. There's the opportunity to do drama if you want. You know, I was in the CCF. I went flying. I went shooting. I went to camps. I went, did all sorts of stuff. But all this gives you a real open-mindedness, and it really encourages you to have a varied life experience. And I think having that varied life experience absolutely improves your resilience, because you're exposed to so many different people. You're exposed to people who have a much harder life than you do. You appreciate the perspective that you need to do things. And I think if I was going to encourage anyone at school at the moment, I would just say do as much as possible within reason. Find what you're interested in, because when you find what you're interested in, it doesn't matter if you stay up until 3 a.m. or when you're going to work the next day on a cold night in the middle of a pandemic, you're doing something that you believe in and you want to do, and it doesn't work. Working then comes easy.
Saab, the 1st of February is a big date for you.
Yes.
Can you tell us what's happening?
Really exciting and incredibly humbled. I'm off to Windsor to receive my MBE for my sort of service to the NHS and my leadership during the pandemic. Incredibly excited. I have to wear a hat. So,
Is that a part of the stipulation? You absolutely have to wear a hat.
Yes, yes. They want you to wear a hat. So that's going to be interesting. But yeah, really excited. So unfortunately, I only can take one person, but I will be taking my two boys so they can experience the whole thing. But it's absolutely great.
And when did you find out? Is it a letter through the post? Is it a text?
Yeah,
an email?
Yeah, this is the crazy story. So it was in late 2020, and I get so many emails, as you can imagine. And I really nearly deleted this email because it was just, you know, and then I opened it and it said, you know, you've been, you awarded it. An MBE, and I was like, "What is this? This is a joke, honestly." But yeah, I had to read it quite a few times for it to sink in. But it was a real curveball.
And is there a kind of drop-down box where you get to choose your royal?
Unfortunately, not. You get who you're given.
And in terms of, so you're taking your two boys down there. What's have you got much idea of how the day's going to pan out?
Yeah, there's a ceremony in the morning, and then we're planning to hopefully go into London, maybe have afternoon tea somewhere, because we should all be sort of dressed up and looking very posh. So, yeah, it'll be a really lovely day.
Fabulous. Well, congratulations. It's fantastic. And it'd be so wonderful for your boys to see you do that. If you can see it, you can be it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Dr. Saab Clare and Dr. Chris Duncan, thank you ever so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure to talk to you on Ed Talks.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Listening to Ed Talks. I hope that you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you have, it would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on whatever app you're listening on, so you can keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave your feedback in the review section. If you're listening on a platform where you can't leave your comments, then please do email me with your feedback. My email address is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. If you would like to feature on this podcast as a guest, then please email Adelaide Bailey at the Development Office. Her email address is aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. That's aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. She's also the person to email with any news that you think should be featuring in Old Ed's publications, either in print or online. Finally, if you think a podcast would enhance the communications of your business, organisation or charity, then I'd love to talk to you about producing it. My email address again is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me again.